Welcome to Mormons on Mushrooms. In this podcast, we discuss alternative methods for healing from trauma and seeking a fulfilling life. We often discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. In addition, the opinions offered by our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the hosts of this podcast. If you'd like to support the program, please visit www.patreon.com/Mormons on Mushrooms. Thank you for listening and enjoy. We'd like to welcome Brandon to the pod. Brandon, thank you so much for joining us today. Maybe you could start off by just telling us a little bit about kind of who you are, your faith journey, or maybe your faith crisis, how, you know, what took you out of the church, and then how you ended up kind of stumbling upon plant medicines.
Yeah. Oh man. Okay. Well, this, there, you could do a, I don't know if you could do a short version of that question, but you can definitely.
We only like long answers.
We can chime in to break it up too. Just as long as you want it to be, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Break it up whenever you want. Okay. But yeah. So yeah, my name is Brandon Crockett. I live in Australia. It's a long story how it got there. And what happened, the way that I connected with the two of you, Doug and Mike, is a little serendipitous since we were talking a minute ago. So I moved to Australia about 3 years ago, and as a direct result of plant medicines, if you want, whatever name you want to call them, entheogens, drugs, whatever, psychedelics,
anything you want, man. We call it all, you know, when we're trying to be real spiritual and sacred, we say plant medicines, but when we're kind of just like getting to the point, we're like drugs.
So the way that we connect is that I wrote an article for Vice recently, and it was called, I grew up Mormon, or I can't even remember what it was called. I grew up Mormon until I found psychedelics. But then I found psychedelics. Okay?
Yeah.
So I wrote this article for Vice that's based on a book that I've also written. The book isn't published yet, and it happens to be called the same name as this podcast. So mine is Mormon on Mushrooms. This podcast, Mormons on Mushrooms. And there's a connection there. Doug and Mike read the article and then reached out to me and says, hey, you want to chat on this podcast? So here we are.
So now we're still plural. We're still Mormons on Mushrooms, the Mormon and the Mormons.
Yeah. Just keeps growing. Yeah, absolutely.
So my journey outside of the faith, well, I'll tell this story, even though I told it a little earlier, we're having audio connections. It really starts when I was a teenager and I attended a fireside. And in the fireside, it was this speaker that would come. He was from another ward. He was in my stake. And he would give this same fireside just about every year. And one of the things that he would do, it was on deception. It was always the same thing about how Satan deceives us. And he leads us down one path. And then once we realize we're too far away, then we need to repent and come back. And so he demonstrated this. He says, I'm going to demonstrate this through an optical illusion. And he pulls out a 2x4 and it's like about 3 feet long. And on one end of it, it has a spiral and it's nailed to the center of the spiral. So as an axis. And he starts to spin the spiral and he tells us, I want you to look at this spiral. I'm going to spin it for about 90 seconds. Now look in the center of it. Don't take your eyes away. And so I looked at it in the center and it was like very, you know, comforting, and it was interesting, and I'm looking at it, and then the 90 seconds are up, and he says, okay, now I want you to look at the palm of your hand. And so I look at the palm of my hand, and it starts to swell and shrink at the same time. It's like, whoa, this is interesting. And then he says, now this is why people like to do drugs. And I said to myself, wow, drugs are awesome. And so,
I know we kind of talked about this, but I just want to chime in one thing there. Isn't it kind of cool that he basically incepted that idea into your head when you were 12 years old? So then you could then grow up to then write the book called Mormon on Mushrooms.
I mean, yeah, it's so many ironies of the whole idea of what is deception, you know, like what kind of deception is happening in the church? What are you deceiving yourself from? Because of all these things that go through your mind, these questions that you have when you're growing up in the faith that you refuse to question because you need to deceive yourself or tell yourself that you're in the wrong for thinking these things. And so there's all sorts of self-deception that happens in the church, which becomes really the theme of what my article in Vice was about, is just about the deception of self-deception and how there's comfort in it. And so growing up in the church, I had questions going back to the age of 12, 13, about, you know, the origins, be it the origins of the Book of Mormon, be it, you know, Native Americans and their origins, how the Garden of Eden was in Missouri, what's the deal with polygamy, whatever it was, just all these questions about it. And I wouldn't talk about it because I never saw anybody ask the hard questions. I remember, actually, this is a funny story. There was a guy in Back to Drugs, too, that was in my ward growing up. They had a family of 6 kids. And they were all a little bit edgy, but one of them was really edgy, but not even like just edgy. It was like straight up like selling marijuana at 14 and whatever. And he would come to church once in a while. And one of the times that he came to church, he was asking really hard questions in teacher's quorum. And at one point, the teacher just got fed up with it. And he was a cool guy. He was fun. And he said it was in some jest, but he says, "Get behind me, Satan."
Oh, shit.
But that was one of the only experiences I had with seeing somebody question, asking hard questions in church. And so I had all sorts of hard questions that I didn't ask.
I just want to talk a little bit, and we don't talk too much about it, but just highlight, I like how you're talking about deception, because I think a lot of times when people think about doing psychedelics, they think, well, I'm, you know, how can I trust my senses, or things are going to be distorted, or I'm going to hallucinate. But also with the deception, I think one of the traumas that I've had as a Mormon, I think a lot of Mormons have, is once you leave the church, I was like, well, this thing I grew up with, I can't trust that anymore. And not only that, but I don't know how to trust myself anymore either. You know, I bought a hook, line and sinker. I was in it. And the church told me, like, part of myself, I would tell that to parts of myself, get behind me, Satan, you know, get thee hence. When I was tempted, you know, shaming parts of myself. So then afterwards, it's like, I don't know. There's so much deception my whole life. It's like, I don't know how I can even trust myself at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm totally at that point right now. And, or have been around it so much. It's like, because now without the faith to fall back on, who do I trust? Because it's always been trusting in the leaders of the church, trusting in the scriptures, trusting that you're going to receive personal revelation or whatever it is. But now it's like, it's on me. And it's really difficult. And I could even say like openly, you know, like I replaced the church with teacher plants, you know, and that became my thing that I leaned on, you know, that I believe in the revelation I'm going to receive from whatever it may be, a mushroom experience or from a cannabis experience or MDMA or whatever. Like, I rely on that in the same way that I would have relied on the faith. But the thing is, it's kind of weird for me personally, is I never really believed, but I was super deep into it. And I like lived the tenets of the faith more than even hardcore believers as a way to compensate for my lack of belief. And so I didn't want to go on a mission. I didn't say it, but I didn't ever schedule an interview with the bishop. Like, I waited for him to approach me, and that didn't happen until I was 19 and a half, just because I didn't want to go, but I didn't know who to tell about it. And so finally he pulled me aside and I interviewed, and I just went through the interview, but I really didn't want to go. I definitely didn't want to go to the temple. I ended up going to the temple, and it was a really difficult experience for me. And then I didn't want to go to BYU. I had really good grades in high school, and I didn't apply to college because I didn't know where I wanted to go. And I knew I didn't want to go to BYU, but I also was afraid of going to somewhere like UCLA, where all my friends, or Berkeley, where my friends were going, because people are going to be drinking, they're going to be having sex, yeah, they're going to be doing drugs, and I'm not going to feel comfortable there. But I also, my little experience I've had at BYU, just being on campus through the years, is like, I don't want to go there. And so, but I ended up going on a mission. I ended up in the end going to BYU. But then I moved to Chicago after BYU, and it was really uncomfortable breaking into the singles scene there. Oh, yeah. But I did, and I gained some comfort because Mormons are a little bit different in a big city. And it was somewhat comfortable. And then I met my future wife there, and she was super hardcore Mormon. I'm going off on many tangents right now. She was super hardcore Mormon.
Yeah.
But before we got engaged, I told her it was only the second time in my life. I say in the article it was the first time in my life. On my mission, I wrote a letter home telling my family that I wasn't sure I believed. And, I told my wife before we got engaged, cause I felt like, hey, I got to tell you, I can't go into a marriage with you believing I'm always going to be strong in the faith and having it come out later. I told her that I wasn't sure that I believed. And she was somehow okay with it because she was really hardcore. She's a super free spirit, challenges all sorts of questions. Like, it was weird because she was hardcore, but she would ask, she would say that it was wrong that women didn't hold the priesthood. And this is like 12 years ago when this was like a really, really fringe idea. And and I was like, and I laughed when she said that. I'm like, that's never going to change. Come on. And so she was challenging. Well,
to your credit, for laughing, actually, I think 12 years ago, well, where was I at 12 years ago? Oh, around that time. I don't know if I would have laughed. I don't know. I'm confused about timelines right now. Anyway.
Yeah.
I guess I've been out of the church for a while now, huh?
It's hard to keep track of those things after you. I mean, I'm just so removed that sometimes people will tell me about things going on in the church, and I'm like, oh, I had no idea. I used to, when I first left the church, I would keep tabs on the church, maybe even better than I did when I was a true believer, because I was like so angry and I wanted to try to catch the church in their lies. But I've moved to the point now where I don't even know what's going on. You know, women could have the priesthood for all I know, right? I mean, I know they don't, but it's funny. Yeah. I want to kind of back up to one thing, and that is the dude at the fireside who's spinning that spiral. You're staring at it for 90 seconds, getting into like a hypnotic trance, and then looking it down at your hand or any other object. I mean, it's an optical illusion that your hand is not actually swelling and shrinking. It's just an optical illusion. And to use that as a, like almost like as an analogy for the way Satan works or the way drugs work or that kind of thing. Speaking of deception, that is deception. Because what happens is, we were all teenage boys. Being a teenage boy, you're kind of confused about, well, what is feeling the spirit versus seeing a real inspirational movie or hearing a really good, you know, music, you know, a good tune or something like that. And you're like, what is Satan? Which one is Satan trying to, you know, tempt me down to hell? And which one is the actual spirit telling me it's like, you know, telling me what is true and what is not? Yeah. All my experiences trying to work deals with Satan. I remember being like 17 years old, watching scrambled porn in my bedroom, and like trying to actually make a deal with Satan. Like, if I could just have like some sexy, big breasted, naked lady appear in my bed, that I would then start doing drugs, and I would start, you know, getting into alcohol and saying swear words and all that kind of stuff. Well, yeah. I mean, I never got that sexy lady in my bed, but I did get into saying swear words, doing drugs, and drinking alcohol. And so it's like, well, did Satan accept my deal? Was that a deal?
Yeah, yeah. that's what's so messed up, because I know, like, look, I've never talked to either of you before, but we have a very common background.
Yep.
You know, and so like, so you say that, and I'm assuming something, but it's like 85% in jest. But there's like, there is a tinge of it that's like still like questioning it in your mind.
Of course.
Am I, you know, and like, and that is just like the harm that comes from living in the faith for so long. And it's like, I've met with a therapist, or I've met with like three different therapists in my life. And one of them that I talk about in the book, Dr. C, he's referred to in the book. It was a guy I met with in Chicago. He came from a Catholic background, but he had also met with my sister-in-law, who's Mormon. And so he was very familiar with the Mormon experience, but like he would just relate Mormonism to Catholicism all the time. And it's like, you don't understand. It's like, it's not the same thing. It's not like, well, I grew up and I went to Catholic school growing up and we had nuns and all that. So I know what you're going through. And it's like, no, it's not. And he didn't throw it away like that. He was sincerely trying to understand it. But there is such a difference between Mormonism and Catholicism. And like, it's so embedded in me that like, I know my better part of myself knows that like there is, that I don't need to feel guilty for these things, or especially the idea of Satan deceived me into this. Satan, blah, blah, blah. Like this actual spirit from the primordial existence that led one third of the hosts of heaven away, that being deceived me. Like, no, that's not like a real thing, but it still is so deeply inside every fiber of my being that like, I can't like rid myself of it. It still like causes jolts within me, like physical things happen as a result of thinking those thoughts.
Yeah. That's so funny. Like thank God for the concept of Catholic guilt, but thank you for saying that because I mean, Catholic guilt is an accepted emotional state across the board worldwide. But I always felt when I would hear that, I would be like, y'all don't know shit about Mormon guilt. Like Mormon guilt is like, dude, no, we're not just doing this because it's tradition and we have a few things and we say a couple of we say a couple of Hail Marys and we do confession. Like our souls are in constant danger at every turn of, you know, not being able to be with our loved ones for eternity. Just because of the misstep here, the misstep there, what we forgot to repent for, what we maybe didn't think it was like a high enough, you know, high level enough sin to repent of. And Mike, you've talked in detail about feelings of guilt on your mission. When you're at your most righteous, when you're at your most Mormon righteous, you're still feeling guilt and you're racking your brain trying to figure out, well, what did I not repent for? What have I not taken care of yet? And that has an emotional toll on a human being. I was going to say a child, but it's not even a child. It has an emotional toll on human beings. We're 40 years old trying to still figure this stuff out.
Yeah. Right. Completely. Like, okay. So bringing up this thing, I don't know if I've ever talked to anybody about this. Okay. So I was in a bishopric in Chicago. I was a first counselor in a bishopric in a singles ward. And it was actually even though I didn't really believe, and even stronger than that, I didn't believe, but I wouldn't be honest with myself about that completely. I still went through everything and I wasn't like a typical Mormon on the outside. I would like talk about oddball things in church all the time and really reason really well. And I wouldn't fit into normal social norms and all that stuff. But anyway, I was still recognized as probably leadership material in the church. And so I became eventually became a bishopric member in Chicago. So when you're talking about being, when you're on your mission, you're in the highest form of Mormonism and you start to feel guilty about things. It's like, what is that little thing that I did that's going to make it so that I can't get to the celestial kingdom or whatever? It's because like, perhaps you stepped into the house of a 70-year-old woman when there wasn't a male present in the home. You know, it's like, I'm now going to go to the celestial kingdom, you know, and you're thinking that. And so what would happen as a bishop in a bishopric, being a part of disciplinary councils, which I hated so much.
Oh my
gosh. It hurt so bad being a part of disciplinary councils. And so like the thought came to me during these, like, or instances is like, if in this, and these are completely hypotheticals, these aren't with real people, and say if you're an elders quorum president and you fornicate or whatever it is, the consequences of doing that are going to be more severe than if you leave the church for a couple of years, you fornicated all the time, and you come back in.
Good point. Like,
okay, so you're fornicating for years or whatever. If you've left the faith, even if you're still a believer, if you leave the faith, it's just going to be like, you know, welcome back. But if you're an elders quorum president and you mess up once, then it's like, oh, not good.
Disfellowshipped is your best case scenario.
Yeah. You know? So if you are interested in fornicating, just leave the church. Leave the church for a few months, experiment with it, and come back in. Then you're okay. But don't do it while you're an active member of the church.
And I'm interested in hearing about your experience with disciplinary councils, because that's something that runs through my head quite a lot. You know,
yeah,
I've had to. So on a professional level, I've had to, part way. You know, I'd have to fire someone for literally stealing from the company. Not mm-hmm. like, oh, we think you might have stolen. Oh, they're, you know, confess or, you know, and everything will be fine. Like literally they stole from the company, and that, you know, mm-hmm. you can't steal from the company that you work for. You're going to get fired. I felt worse. I felt more empathy for that person. I felt bad, dude. I was like, oh, they made a mistake. Maybe they got caught up in something. Maybe they got whatever. And we had to let that, you know, a person go when they steal from a company.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, these guys, you know, high councilmen, bishoprics, stake presidents, they sit on disciplinary councils where they are basically expelling a person from the religion that is their primary identity for having sex with someone they love that they're not married to, as an example. Mm-hmm. That's the crime they committed that I would make the argument has a much bigger impact on their sense of well-being and their eternal soul and their identity with their relationship with God than, losing your job because you actually caused harm. You actually stole from a company. So it almost feels like to sit on those would be so conflicting. To sit on those disciplinary councils would be so conflicting, because when you kind of strip away and take back some of the, here's our doctrine, here's our rules, it's like this person's crime was that they had sex with the person they love.
Yeah.
And maybe that person happens to be the same gender as them, or maybe they're not married and it's like a 19-year-old kid who should be on a mission. We're going to excommunicate. That's a weird thing for me to wrap my head around.
Yeah. I mean, even like the idea of having sex with somebody you love being punishment, but even just having sex out of curiosity, you know, like I think that's fine too, you know,
absolutely.
Just out of curiosity, but like that's even another level. But like when you're a Mormon, the idea of having sex with, like, if you love them, you wouldn't have sex with them. You know, like, so this is right there. That's like entering into a bad territory, right? That's like evidence of sin. Like that's evidence of deception. That's evidence of deception. You've been deceived by Satan. If you want to have sex with them before you're married, you've been deceived by Satan, because that's not an expression of love. But once you're married, oh, everything's good. Even anal or whatever, you know, well, depends on who you're talking to, but,
it's all between a husband and wife. Well, it depends on if you ask like Spencer Kimball, you know, that's totally off the table. But then we got a little bit more progressive, you know, Hinckley sort of started being a little bit like, well, it's all in the bedroom and just worry about that. Yeah. But man, how can a person feel good about doing anything with their mate, with the partner they're sealed to, when their whole life they've been told, you are committing a heinous act. You are committing a crime against this person. Yeah.
Okay. So getting to the book, and this will tie some things together right here. So long story short, there's so much to talk about with this.
Dude, long story long.
Terrence McKenna. If I say Terrence McKenna, do you know who he is?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay. And I think our listeners will too, or they can look, but yeah, very, I guess just give it like a 1 minute or 30 second overview, Terrence McKenna.
Okay. All right. So Terrence McKenna is, I'll tell you how I came across Terrence McKenna.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. I can tell you the whole book, but I'll, okay. So going back to, well, Terrence McKenna, okay. Oh man, there's so many details I got to tell you. Okay, I'll do it anyway. I told my wife before we married, I didn't really believe in Mormonism, but we still got married. We got married mm-hmm. in the Salt Lake Temple. Everything's good. But then after we were married, one night we sit down and we were going to write goals. And it's like, I don't like writing goals. I know that's a very Mormon thing to do, but I don't like writing goals. And she loved it. And we worked our way through it. But then we got to this section about missionary work. And I never liked missionary work. I had just been the branch mission leader in our singles ward, and it was really hard for me. But then she wanted to make goals about missionary work, and we couldn't see eye to eye on it. So she wanted to make a goal of how many people we'd have taught in our home that year. And I'm like, I can't do that, you know, but I can make a goal to talk to people about the church, but I can't make a goal about numbers. And we couldn't get on the same page. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Shortly after that, this guy in our ward was getting baptized. And I won't use his name. I'll call him Eddie for now. Mm-hmm. We attended his baptism shortly after we made these goals as a way of like showing my wife, hey, we're on the same page. We're going to go to this baptism at least. Mm-hmm. I talked to Eddie afterwards and I invite him over for dinner. And I invite him over with another friend of mine in Chicago who is a fringe Mormon at best. We'll call him Akili. He was a Black American and super well-versed in Mormonism, but also way into conspiracy theories. And so we hit it off.
Okay. So, like, yeah, that's really, like my kind really of, that's off. My kind. Yeah, I'm with him too.
Good dinner party.
Akili, yeah.
Yeah. So he and I would meet up for lunch often. And then Eddie and I were paired as home teachers, and Akili was one of the people that we were asked to home teach. And so I invited them over and we were having this dinner and we're talking about, and this guy, Eddie, he asked me this question. Eddie, by the way, he's from Liberia, and he had told me that he had been working at the University of Utah doing research, but he said he'd gotten fired for racist reasons. And he says that it's not true. What happened was I was put on a research project, and it was a neurological research project. And I found an easy answer to this question that had been perplexing the research doctor for years. And she didn't take kindly to it and saw that he got fired. And then he says, but this similar things happened to me when I was working at Duke, and it happened to me when I was working at the NIH, and it happened to me when I was working at Georgetown, I believe the other location was. So he'd been doing neurological research in these different places. And then he ended up going to Chicago. We invite him over for dinner. He had just been baptized, and he says, well, I have a question about baptism for the dead. And so we start talking about baptism for the dead, and I'm explaining the doctrine of it. And then he says, okay, Brandon, I'm not questioning the doctrine of it. Okay, I'm going to question you on this. He says, if I take this glass of water right here, and he holds it up in his hand, says, and if I drink it, can I make it so that you are no longer thirsty?
Oh, yeah.
And I said, well, Eddie, I can't explain to you the metaphysics of how baptism for the dead works, but it's a concept that the church believes in. And he gets this smile on his face when I said the word metaphysics. And then it led to this other discussion. Now, what happened was my other friend Akili, who was into conspiracy theories, he would always walk around with this big stack of books, no matter where he'd go, that he picked up at the library. And when he came over that night, he had this huge stack of books.
He just brings books with him?
He just walks around with a stack of books.
I love this guy.
And so he comes over and he has a stack of books. When he comes over that night, he places them on the table, and the book that's on the top is on Freemasonry. And I'm like, oh man, we're having Eddie come over. I don't want him to see a book on Freemasonry. He's going to get all weirded out when he sees Freemasonry, and he's gonna find Joseph Smith was a Freemason and blah blah blah. And so Akili places the stack of books on the table, and Freemasonry is on the top, and I'm trying to distract Akili so that I can put something on top of the Freemasonry book. And at that point, Eddie knocks on the door. I open it up, and I don't have a chance to place anything on a Freemasonry book. So after dinner, after this metaphysics discussion about baptism for the dead, then walks over directly to the pile of books, and he says, oh, Freemasonry, blah, blah, blah. He starts talking about Freemasonry. And then my friend Akili says, did you know that Joseph Smith was a Freemason? And I'm like, no, don't bring it up right now. New member of the church, don't bring this up. No. And he says, And then Akili says, and that's why he was killed, because he was sharing Freemason secrets. and then Eddie looks at me, he says, "Is this true?" And I said, "Yeah, well, it's kind of true. And yes, Joseph Smith was a Freemason." And then Eddie says, "I knew it. I knew it. This makes so much sense. I knew that a boy prophet couldn't just make this up on his own. I knew he was influenced by this. This makes me believe in the prophet even more." And whoa. then he starts talking about how he's a member of all of these different metaphysical occult organizations and mystery schools. And he starts listing them off. He's a Rosicrucianist. And he explains to me how Rosicrucianism had this schism. It became this other organization called AMORC, which he says is the more true form of Rosicrucianism. But then that had an offshoot group that became this group called BOTA, B-O-T-A, which is Builders of the Adytum. And Adytum is a Greek word for inner shrine. And he says that this is a true metaphysical order. Speaking about the tarot, he says they are true practitioners of the tarot. And he starts explaining these things to me. And then he starts talking about this other school, which I can't remember, the Martinist order. He starts talking about these different organizations that he's a part of. And then it kicks off all these like occult and esoteric and metaphysical conversations I start having with him for the next couple months. We meet up regularly. We talk on the phone often. We email each other, and conversations get super weird. And but it also always relates back to the church because he knows that's my language. Yeah. But I always been interested in this stuff. In Boston, where I served my mission, there are tons of Freemasons. And also within the Haitian community, I spoke Haitian Creole on my mission. There are tons of Freemasons in Haiti. And so you come across it often, but I'm always interested in it, but I couldn't talk about it with anybody. And so then at BYU, I met this guy who was really into Egyptian mysticism, and he introduced that to me. And we started talking about it. But when I met this guy, Eddie, it started to come together. He started to give me these books, and he started sending me these emails. But anyway, he really wanted me to join this group called BOTA, but he couldn't recruit me. He says that's one of the rules. You can't recruit people. And then one day I asked him, I said, "Well, how do you join this organization?" He says, "I thought you would never ask." and then he refers me to the website, and he says, "But I cannot push you to join it. You must do it on your own." Yeah. And so I start looking into it. I consider doing a correspondence course. It's like $15 a month or something. I'm super cheap. So I didn't, because I'm Mormon, I'm really cheap. And
frugal, thrifty. You're brave, clean, and reverent. Yeah.
So I didn't do it. And also it was a major rift in my relationship with my wife. And she didn't like this guy. Like, she was very questionable of him. He was on the outside very weird in certain ways, but also like the smartest person I have ever met. Yeah. But very strange socially in some ways. But anyway, I didn't join. We ended up having a falling out. I've never had a falling out with anybody except for one roommate in college. And he moved to Washington, D.C. And just after about 2 months. And then, but then what happened was I was so into esoteric stuff that for Christmas that year, my wife, to make up for like this rift that we had, she gave me a membership to a local mystery school called the School of Metaphysics in Chicago. Yeah. Hmm. And it was a really small organization. It met in a house. It had like six people that met in it. They were at the beginning. It ended up being me with these two like 50-year-old women. And we just meet every week, and we'd have readings. We'd do things like we'd learn meditation techniques. We'd do different like breathing techniques or different exercises that you do. Lots of reading. There would be about a book a week on these esoteric teachings. It was all interesting. But then a couple months into it, got a little bit too culty for me.
Yeah.
And I just like questioned it, but I still lasted another 6 months until I went to Washington, D.C. with my wife's family. And one day we're waiting for the train. And then who appears next to me? This guy, Eddie,
just randomly. Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah. Just appears next to me. And so we start talking, and we get on the train together. I introduce him to my wife's family. And then he says to me afterwards, he said, "We need to talk." And I reach out to him when I get back to Chicago. I email him. I'm like, "I'm going to this mystery school right now. I'm feeling really uncomfortable with it for this, this, and this reason. what do you say? And he says, well, if you ever feel uncomfortable in mystery school, you should stop attending. And then he says this, and he says, and by the way, Brandon, I got the feeling, in quotes, that your wife is pregnant. And she was. She was less than 3 months pregnant, and you couldn't see it at all. And so I stopped attending the mystery school. I sent this somewhat nasty email to them, and it wasn't nice. I don't normally do things like that. Like saying certain things I didn't like with what they did. And then I stopped attending, but I kept doing certain exercises from the, that they taught us in the school, including like guided meditations and such. And I kept looking them up on YouTube, guided meditations. And one day I saw this link to a 2-hour video that I really wanted to watch, but it was 2 hours. Yeah. And it was by this, and the thumbnail on it just like looked like this really interesting guy. He was wearing this sweater. He had this long beard and he had these round glasses. And I'm like, I don't know why, but this guy looks really cool. And it had this interesting title and it was called like Dreaming Awake at the End of Time or something like that. And I clicked on it after seeing it like 10 times recommended for me. I finally clicked on it and it ended up being a talk from Terrence McKenna, 2 hours long. And I was instantly hooked. I had never heard anybody speak like this before. And so he starts talking about psychedelics and he starts like giving them. And I don't know if you've ever seen the Blue Boy episode of Dragnet, like the show that used to be on Nick at Night.
I remember Dragnet, but I don't. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. It's a good episode. It's this guy that does LSD and he has this bad experience on it. And then the Dragnet cops show up and they start talking about the dangers of LSD and have this really like preachy message. Don't do LSD. That was like my exposure to LSD growing up. Yeah. Also listening to a lot of Pink Floyd and Jimi Hendrix, but like, I didn't have any real, overhearing some people doing mushrooms and such. But, suddenly this guy's talking about the legitimate benefits of psychedelics from a psychological, scientific, anthropological, spiritual point of view. And especially the spiritual point of view was what like got me interested, that he's saying that the world religions seem to be connected to psychedelics. Not only that, but man going from pre-hominid man to Homo sapien is a result of mushroom use. Okay? And it's like, what is this? And I was just like hooked. And I was still a member of the church. I was in a bishopric at the time that this was going on. And I just started listening to him every day for an hour or so for months. And I just, there are just countless lectures of him on YouTube. He's dead. Terrence McKenna. So Terrence McKenna, yeah, it was this ethnobotanist, he calls himself. But really revolutionary, died in the year 2000, but was saying all of these ideas back then are especially ringing true today, especially last year, about like the poison of male dominator culture and the Western civilization infiltrating the globe, capitalism just being the poison that's ruining the world. Now, he's not the first to say this stuff, but he was saying it with the psychedelic bend and that psychedelics were the key to helping overcome these things, because this is what has been used all throughout time to just cause revolutionary thought. And that this is what will lead us to what would call the second coming almost. I mean, I'm putting words in his mouth, but I'm also trying to speak from a Mormon perspective. This is what will change, lead to the moment of singularity. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
how much Terrence McKenna were you weaving into your church talks at the time?
Oh man, that's a great question. So I started to talk about Terrence McKenna to people, but even psychedelics, this is like 5-6 years ago, were such a fringe idea even then. Uh-huh. It was like, I didn't know how to talk to about it with people. But what ended up happening, and I don't know if you're going to be familiar with what I'm about to talk about, but I was listening to McKenna so much, and I'd be like, man, the language he's using is really similar to what Joseph Smith language. And one day in particular, I was listening to a lecture of his, and he quoted this other author, this psychedelic author, who said that the feeling of coming under the influence of ayahuasca is like the sound of rushing waters. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, 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 wow. And I was like, okay, I know that that's not a phrase unique to Mormonism, but it's used in the Doctrine and Covenants to describe the voice of Jehovah. Yep. It's also used in the book of Revelation to describe the voice of the Lord. And so I was like, huh, I'm just going to look it up, see if anybody's done any research on this. And at the time, I typed in Joseph Smith, psilocybin mushrooms. And I just searched it. And I stumbled upon this paper by this doctor, this Boise emergency room doctor named Robert Bexted.
Robert Bexted, yeah.
Bexted, yeah, yeah. Robert Bexted. Okay, so I found his paper and I read it and I was like, I knew I was going to find things on Reddit. I knew I was going to find things on ex-Mormon or whatever, but I wanted a legitimate academic paper that somebody had done. Now, his paper isn't a legitimate academic paper in the sense that it wasn't published at the time. But I read it and I'm like, this guy's done research on it way more than I've done. He's actually stumbled on this idea. He has all these sources and I'm like, great. So I loved it. And then I started to talk to people about it. Mm-hmm. And so like I was in the bishopric. I remember one conversation that I had with the executive secretary or the clerk. He's the clerk. We're doing tithing one day and he was a convert and he joined the church when he was like 20, went on a mission to Uganda and had just been back. And
Uganda. And,
yeah. Yeah. Like Book of Mormon Africa, music.
Pasadiga, yeah. Ibawai.
Orlando,
we are Africa.
I am Africa.
Yeah. Oh, so I start telling him about it. I'm like, hey, and I was speaking, and it was what would the tone be? It kind of snide a little bit, but like I know more than you a little bit when I bring up these topics of like esotericism, mysticism in the early church and whatever. I'm not an expert on the subject, especially back then, but I'd like do it with like, hey, did you know this? Blah blah blah. And so I was like, I've been reading lately. I think Joseph Smith seems to have used psychedelic mushrooms to cause his revelations. And I can't remember exactly what I said, but I talked about something like that. And then he said this, he says, well, if you could connect with God through a plant, why wouldn't God do that? And like that has stuck with me ever since, because this guy didn't grow up in Mormonism. And he said that like, because he's using his brain.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, and it was like, and he was a really nice guy. I have no contact with him anymore, but like a not a naive guy. He had like an innocence to him, but not a Mormon innocence because he didn't grow up in the church, but he was just like a sincere, nice person. Mm-hmm. And that always stuck with me. But if I talked to the few times I would talk to people that grew up in the church about it, it's just like, yeah. Like, don't, like, what are you talking about? You're crazy. You know,
sacrilegious. Like, I mean, it's almost sacrilege to suggest such a thing, you know,
but they wouldn't say that because Mormons aren't like contentious, you know, it's just like they get uncomfortable and change the subject or whatever it was. And so I didn't have anybody I could talk to. I talked to my younger brother about it, 'cause we talked about everything. He's still in the church, but that when that happened, when I read that paper, and eventually I've read Bryce Blankenagel and Cody Nochoni's paper. They wrote one that was later. And then the three, Bexted, Nochoni, and Blankenagel, wrote a paper together that is actually studied. It's in my hand right now. I love this thing.
What's the title of it?
It's The Entheogenic Origins of Mormonism, a Working Hypothesis. This has actually been published in the Journal of Psychedelic Studies. It's the longest paper that journal has ever published. It's super good. It's a super paper. It combines all the work of everybody. And I've talked to Bryce a couple of weeks ago about this. I love it. Like it's so, so, so good. But the ties to Mormonism and psychedelics, in my opinion, who am I? I'm not anybody. In my opinion, are very clear. And it's not just because Mormonism is unique. No, it was happening in the area at the time. I haven't done the research on it, but I'm quite sure that any religious movement at the time had ties to psychedelics, especially in that area of upstate New York where so many religions
were being started. Access to those entheogens and doTERRA and all. Yeah, I mean, totally.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump in to just add for, you know, you guys or listeners. I'm fairly close with Dr. Bexted, and, you know, this guy's been excommunicated, rebaptized, re-excommunicated because of these beliefs. And there's an amazing podcast. I don't know the name of the podcast. I'm sorry. It was a one-off for me that I listened to. But he explains the stuff that we currently are talking about and I think are going to keep talking about. He explains it so well. I mean, you know, Dr. Beckstead's like a pretty low-key, even-keeled intellectual guy. I mean, he's not just like on some crazy whim trying to like get some conspiracy theory. He presents himself and his research very clearly, and it's really hard to poke holes in. So I think that if you just Google Robert Beckstead podcast, you'll find it's about a 2-hour podcast where he lays this all out really clearly. Anyway, oh, wow. Sorry to interrupt, Brandon. No, I just
like, tell me, sorry, that's a good plug there. Yeah, because yeah. I'm going to check that out.
Because if like whatever I say may be entertaining, maybe inspire people, whatever to open their mind to psychedelics or whatever it is. But the key is the research that this guy did. I will sing his praises. I've never met him before, but what he's done is so important.
Yeah, he's awesome. So
important. And like people aren't going to get it right now. They're probably going to get it in like 10 years or something like that, that like what he's done, because now I can talk about this and not be crazy. Like if he didn't do this work, I'd be talking about this right now and it'd be like people would shut the podcast off and not even consider it. Because his willingness to talk about the ties of the church to psychedelics in a time when psychedelics were super taboo. This is like 2009 or whatever it was. He was talking about this. Like they were super fringe for general society back then. And to say that Mormonism had a tie to psychedelics, that religion had a tie to psychedelics, religion in general having ties to psychedelics is something that's been going on for decades, but has always been a really fringe idea until very recently. It's becoming quite mainstream with this book written by the Immortality Key by Brian Murarescu. So he's on Joe Rogan and now suddenly it blows up and it's like a bestseller on Amazon. But showing the ties of early Christianity to psychedelics, ancient Greece to psychedelics, these are things that he didn't make up like himself. These have been talked about since John Allegro and Carl Ruck and people in the early 70s and 50s and such. But he found physical evidence to support this. That was his key. He found physical evidence to support this that there had just been conjecture before, but a lot of conjecture that threw it together. So Beckstead did this at a time when these ideas weren't mainstream at all. He talks about it, publishes it on his own, and like you said, gets excommunicated. I don't know the story, but now he's getting legitimacy to it. And I am not a prophet. But we're all prophets on our own. We're all our personal prophets.
Bingo. Bingo.
But if I had to prophesy anything, it would be in another 10 years, the church is going to openly talk about this in the same way that they openly talk about Seer Stones and Joseph Smith looking into a hat to translate.
Totally agree. Totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that'll be a great day. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. I don't know how they're going to reckon with it. I mean, it's the same thing. Oh, I got to tell you guys, like your shadow.
I love when you get excited, Brandon. It's a boyish excitement that I love. Okay.
So the only episode I've listened to yours, I just want to listen to it the other day. This is a funny thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I all these people at work have read my article now. And then I said, I told a friend I'm going to be on podcast this weekend. And they're like, what podcast? I said, well, it has the same title as the book, Mormons on Mushrooms. And I was like, I got to listen to an episode before I'm on it. And they're like, why? Because like, you're afraid of your job. Are they going to be like racists or something like that? You know, they're going to say something racist. You got to make sure you have to like, you know, is that why you need to listen to them beforehand? I'm like, they're not going to be racist. But you do realize that in my article, I talked about how I got high on cannabis. My wife started to prophesy, said we should move to Australia. And we moved to Australia because of a result of getting high. You realize that that's on Vice now and on the internet. Like if I'm going to get fired for something, it's not for having a controversial discussion on a podcast with people that I don't know, you know, like I've already overstepped that line
out there. Yeah. Yeah.
believe us. We know the way that feels when those walls are kind of closing in a little bit. We're with you on that. We got you.
So I listened to your shadow episode. I just randomly picked one.
Yeah.
And this is great. Okay.
Yeah.
Mormonism carries a heavy shadow. And now I'm going to relate this back to what is probably my first psychedelic experience, and which happened when I was like 16. Hey, did you ever recreationally pass out?
Yes. Oh,
yes, we did that. Yes.
That. I've got kind of a horror story. I'll tell it just real quick. We would do this recreational pass out where you do that and you'd push their neck like that and they'd pass out.
Yeah.
I did it once in the bathroom just to a kid in elementary school. He fell down, hit his head on the toilet and cracked his head open.
Oh,
it's like a very traumatic experience for me.
Yeah.
But anyway, not to put a damper on this conversation. But.
Okay. I had a traumatic one too, but I also had an amazing one.
Okay.
So, I didn't hang out with a lot of Mormons growing up, and, I did for like a 6 month period. And, one time I was invited to hang out with these Mormons, like during a 6 month period. And this guy who was like the charismatic leader of the group, he was like 6'3". He looked like a 40-year-old when he's 17, you know, one of those guys. And, and he just says randomly, he's like, "Does anyone want to pass out?" And like, "What are you talking about? Pass out?" And he's like, "Oh no, it's really easy. All you do is you bend over, you hyperventilate, and then you stand up and put my hands on your lap, and you just pass out."
Like, whatever you did to your microphone there was kind of cool, but it like did like this Darth Vader voice.
Yeah, you suddenly sounded like Vader.
So he's like, "Who wants to do it?" I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, "I'm not going to be the first to do this, but if somebody else does it and they don't die, I'll be the second one to do it." And so this girl who's like real petite, like 5 feet, she's like, "I'll do it." And she goes up, she hyperventilates, he puts his hands on her neck. And then she says, she like starts laughing, and then all of a sudden her eyes roll back and she falls to the floor real slowly. And once she hits the floor, she starts laughing. And I took her laugh as like, aha, she broke her performance. She broke character. This is all fake. And she gets up. She's like, no, it was real. I don't even know what happened. It was real. And I'm like, okay, I'll do it. And so he does it to me. I hyperventilate. I stand up. He puts his hands on my neck. And then it's not working. And all of a sudden, boom, I'm gone. And I see like this, I'm like at night, kind of night. And there's like this inky black sea. And then there's a moon, what seems to be a moon that's reflecting on the waters. And there's like this gentle ripple on it, this white light. But then the song in my head, I don't know if you listened to Tool or if you listened to Tool back in the day. Okay. So the song 46 and 2 started playing through my head. And then it was gone. And then I came back and I'm like, I'm on the floor. I'm like, whoa, what just happened? What just happened? It was the coolest thing. Okay. And so I went home, and the next morning I told my parents all about it. and so it's like, I never got involved in mischief or anything. So I never learned the delicate art of what you're supposed to tell your parents and what you're not supposed to tell them. And so I told my parents that, and they're like, "Brandon, that doesn't sound like something you should be doing." And it's like, "Oh, but it was all good. It was good. Blah, blah, blah." And it's like, "No, I don't think you should be doing that anymore." So anyway, I bring this up because, and then I had a bad experience, and I made my friend pass out on Monday. My friend Tommy, who's the main character in this book, I made him pass out at school, and then he started having seizures on the ground.
Yeah.
And I was like, so he goes down, he falls down on the ground, and he starts having seizures. My friends are all around watching it. Once he goes into seizures, my friends scatter like ducks after a gunshot, you know, and I'm left on the ground with Tommy, and I'm shaking him. I'm like, Tommy, wake up, Tommy. And then his eyes roll back and he's like, whoa. And then he gets up and the bell rings and we go to French class. But so I never did it again. And then Gordon B. Hinckley came out and said we shouldn't do it in a general conference address.
Yeah, like, I remember that.
So,
oh, did he really?
Yeah.
Oh my god!
Because it was sweeping the church. I mean, I remember doing it, and I honestly would say that I agree with Gordon Hinckley on this one. It's not that safe of a thing to do. If you're going to do that kind of stuff, do light as a feather, stiff as a board. Go do Bloody Mary in the mirror. You know. do fucking truth or dare or spin the bottle 8 minutes in heaven.
Avoid. Well, I'm not like shocked that he would speak out. I just was shocked that it was a big enough deal that Gordon B. Hinckley would speak out. I think it would enter his realm.
Yeah. I mean, it must've been a trend in the Mormon community, you know,
I mean, I was doing it.
I got exposed to it. Yeah. And you're doing it too. And I think we're all about the same age. So it was just that time, mid late 90s, that this is happening. Yeah. And but I bring this up because the song 46 and 2, and this is super ironic that this happened, is all about the shadow.
Yeah.
And it's a reference to Carl Jung and shadow work, and about how we all carry a shadow with things, that baggage from the past that we don't address, that then surfaces in odd ways. And 46 and 2, the title of the Tool song, is a reference to 46 chromosomes of in the human organism, or whatever you want to call it. And then plus 2 is when we evolve to the next step of the God man, you know, what are we going to be? What is it, the evolution post 46 chromosomes? And that's when you do your shadow work, when you evolve into the greater being.
That's so cool, because even the visuals you were describing of an ocean and waves and the moon, I was thinking shadow, like your subconscious, you know, night. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, this was my first psychedelic experience, no psychedelics involved, but it's very similar to a psychedelic experience or conscious dream or whatever you want to call it. And it relates to the shadow, which then related to your episode. And I just really liked what you talked about. And I didn't cry when I was talking about it, but I was getting emotional. I was feeling the spirit, if you want to say that. The idea, like, because it's something I'm reckoning with, especially recently. I've tried to deny it, like talk about how, oh, but the church was good for me. I knew all these good people through church, which is true. But I also met a lot of people that carry heavy shadows. And I carry an extremely heavy shadow from Mormonism. And it surfaces in odd ways. And I'd like to rid myself of the shadow, but it's very uncomfortable because it's what I know. And anything that you're going into an uncomfortable area, it's like, or ridding yourself of the comfort of the known, it's difficult to move past. And so the shadow is of Mormonism, to acknowledge, like, I carry a really heavy shadow from Mormonism when I was listening to that episode. And I've known that, but to really acknowledge that as a result of listening to that episode has helped me over the last few days.
Oh my gosh. I love that. Well, I want to kind of shift gears, because you've mentioned this a couple of times. Before I shift gears, this is very serendipitous that you're talking about. I want to go back to like the mystery schools, Freemasonry, Boda, that kind of stuff. Because right now I'm plowing through Manly P. Hall's book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages. Mm-hmm. And it's about all of these mysteries, mystery schools, forms of Freemasonry, Freemasonry weaving its way through mythology, religious beliefs, all of that kind of stuff. It's fascinating. Highly recommend if you guys want to pick up a copy. It's a big old, it's like 800 page book, but it's like, Mike, I was going to recommend it to you anyway. So this is a perfect time, because it's right in line with what we're talking about. But Brandon, I'm so interested in, you've mentioned a number of times the like unwavering piety of your wife, like your wife's like dedication to the church.
Yeah.
So you hint at this in the article, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about, okay, where are we at now? What happened with her? What happened there?
Okay. Now I had discovered Terrence McKenna, and I got way into Terrence McKenna, and I was like way into Terrence McKenna, but really wasn't strongly considering using psychedelics. I was curious about it. I was still a member of the church, all this stuff, and a bishopric. And so, but I would talk to her about it, but it was such an odd idea that she wouldn't know. She wouldn't say, don't talk about it, but she wouldn't encourage it.
Yeah.
And she's always been very open and curious and all this stuff. But her main thing was, even as I was getting into like the mystical teachings and esotericism and the occult and all that, which was really dabbling, wasn't getting super deep into it. But she was like, why can't you just go into the deeper into Mormonism? There's so much we don't know about Mormonism. Just stick to Mormonism. And I'm like, but Mormonism doesn't have the answers. Mormonism, yeah. like in the sense of Mormonism won't even talk about its past. It won't even acknowledge that it has these esoteric, these mystical teachings within it. It doesn't even acknowledge that. It's trying to distance itself from it. And so if I go to the source of what so much Mormonism is about, I can find the answers to Mormonism within it. You know, and she's like, but what about the temple? And it's like, what about the temple? She said, but there's so much we don't know about the temple that you can delve into. Like, she would get into how one of the signs has to do with, like, one of the specific hand shapes that you make has to do with you receiving a stone with your name on it. Yeah. So they look more into that. And it's like, but that's where it ends. Nobody yeah. knows what it means beyond that. And what does that even mean? I get a stone with my name on it because I put my hand in this specific shape. Like, that's not directly taught there. It's all like, I'm just assuming things, you know, so I can't get deeper into Mormonism and find answers. I need to go to the source of where Mormonism finds its roots to find what Mormonism means. And so we didn't see eye to eye on that. And then what happened was my brother left the faith. And what happened to him, ironically, is that he moved to Australia for six months.
Really? Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. He's not still there.
He is here now. He moved here temporarily for 6 months, moved back to Utah. And then when my dad passed away, he moved here permanently. And then a year later I moved here with my wife. So my wife, my brother left the faith. My brother was preparing a talk in Australia and he was just doing innocent research, Googling some things. And then he stumbles on something and then he's like, what's that? And he stumbles on something else and so like, what's that? And then it leads to another thing and it's like, and
that's then, a part of Mormonism you can go deep on and get lost in for sure.
So it takes him and his wife like two or three more years before they leave the faith, but he leaves the faith. My wife and I are still in it, but then we're visiting them. And during his whole like departure from the church, we talk very openly about stuff. And then once he's out of the faith, we still talk very openly. I don't like shun him at all. We talk about whatever still. And because he knew that I was on my way out too. My wife wasn't at the time. And then my brother introduces my wife to Mormon stories. And so
that's the end. That is the end. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, sorry, go ahead. But yeah,
that's it. She listens to, you know, like 40 episodes in a month. And then she doesn't want to be a part of the faith anymore. Here I am listening to Terrence McKenna every day. I'm like, no, let's stay. Like, I'm comfortable now. I'm finally at a comfortable stage. I don't believe, but I like going to church.
It's so similar. And I've told my story plenty of times, but I was one who introduced my wife to Mormon stories. But I was cherry picking all the episodes. I was only listening to like liberal Mormon stuff. And then I think I was out of town one time on a work trip and she went down a rabbit hole, came back and she was out. And I was like, no, we're liberal Mormons. We're not like not Mormons.
Yeah. Isn't it funny? Like for folks who are interested in the things that we talk about in this podcast, it's like Terrence McKenna, Alan Watts, Robert Thurman, Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, John DeLynn. it's so funny how that works. Like it's
okay. Oh,
shout out John DeLynn. Good job, John.
Yeah. It's thank you, okay. Oh, but the relationship between them all is what becomes really interesting. So anyway, so that's what happens to my wife. And then she starts to get a little more open to the psychedelic stuff I'm talking to now that she doesn't have as much of the shadow of Mormonism. She's at least exposed to the idea there is a shadow. And then eventually we start experimenting. Well, actually right after we leave, then we start experimenting with alcohol. We start with a former Mormon friend who teaches us about Red's apple cider and Mike's hard lemonade.
You got to start with the sweet. Got to start with the sweet stuff. Yeah.
Mike, I drank so much Mike's hard limeade to start. Like, I think my blood still runs a little bit citrusy from that limeade.
The first time my wife and I drank wine, we had a Moscato.
Oh, yeah.
I was sick after that bottle, man. Like, it's so sweet.
Yeah, Moscato. I mean, I can get down with some Moscato, but it is sweet, man. It's tough. Anyway.
Not one to get drunk on. You have like a little bit of a glass here and there.
That's the thing. Like, I'm still not used to it. Like the idea, I mean, I don't drink much, but like, I like hard liquor more than anything else because it's like, why would I want to drink six of anything? You know, like six beers. It's like so much to drink. Why would I want to do that? You know,
I love beer though. I love beer and wine.
I do like beer. I do like kombucha beer has been my saving grace lately. Yeah, that's what I'm drinking right now. Kombucha beer.
So, eventually we drink a bit and then I invite a friend over from work. I like kind of befriend this guy who, is a younger guy and I'm like, can you teach us how to smoke marijuana? You know? And so
you said that. Well, yeah, we didn't hear that. That was important. I want to hear that again. That line.
So I whispered to him, I said like, basically after getting to know him for months, I like invite him over. Can you teach us how to smoke marijuana? And, so he comes over and I remember seeing a sandwich bag of a guy that had $400 worth in high school, but that was like the closest I'd ever come to it. And so he pulls out, he has this little like manicure kit. It looks like shaving kit basically. And he pulls it out and he has what he calls his bubbler. And I haven't even seen one since. I've never seen one of these, but it's like basically a small bong. You put a little water in it and then like just a pinch of weed. I thought you'd have to smoke way more than that. And he shows us how to do it. And I take a few hits. I didn't cough on my first one. I was so proud of myself.
Not only did I cough, but I blew it all out of the bowl. My wife packed the bowl really well. I inhaled and immediately like all of it goes everywhere because I like snorted and coughed.
So my wife only took one hit that night but I took like six and like, this is what happened. Like I instantly just like started, not instantly, but a few minutes later, just started like laughing for no reason, just like laughing, but largely at the absurdity of this. Here I am in my mid 30s. My wife's around 30. She's inviting my coworker who's like 22 over to her house to teach us how to smoke marijuana as former Mormons. Just the absurdity of the situation.
So great. I love
cracking
it.
Up at it. And also I'm starting to get a little bit high. But then there's a moment I stand up and then like close my eyes and open them. And it's like when you go to the optometrist and they're like, number one or number two? Number two, number three, or whatever it is with the spirometer or whatever it's called, they put in front of your face. It was as if like I blinked and it went from lens number one to lens number two.
Oh, I love that.
And like, I just saw the world differently and it's like, whoa. And like, I'm high. And so like, but then like, it was an interesting experience the whole evening, but like, I could tell instantly that my coworker was high too, but I knew my wife wasn't. And so like, I like started to see his aura. Like I didn't physically see it, but I like knew it was there. I started to see like things in the ceiling. I started to like be able to like coordinate my movements with him. Like he could stand up and I could just do like jujitsu or whatever around him. And he'd be able to dodge it or whatever it was. And I just thought it was so funny. And then I started to like have these experiences where I'm like, this is all for me. The world was created for me. This is my creation.
Oh, yes. All the time.
And so like, then I get like the feeling, like I understand, like, and this has happened many times since then. It's like, I've had to resist myself at times. Like I've really had the urge at times to like running out in the street and say, I am Jesus Christ. Like, you know, it's like, and it's like, no, I know I'm not, but like, I get it now. I get it. I get that feeling. I understand why that stereotype exists. I get it. Yeah. So like I had a little bit of that night and then I had, and then I got super turned on. Like I like wanted to have sex with my wife so bad. And I thought she did too. And then it ends up, long story short, she didn't. And then like once I realized, oh, you don't, I was like super shamed. I was like, oh,
sorry. Yeah.
Like I'm not, oh, you weren't on the same page. I'm so sorry. Like, and I didn't do anything like inappropriate, whatever. I like touched her shoulders at some point and like made it clear that I wanted something to happen. And she's like, no, Brandon, like, I don't want to. And then I'm like, oh, and
no means no, Brandon.
yeah, for real. And then like, then my coworker, who I don't know overheard any of this at all, cause it was in another room. And then he left shortly after, and then it was like all awkward. And then my wife went to bed, and I was left to myself to write notes of my experience. Anyway, that was my first time getting high.
But real quick, I just want to say, cause I have the same experience where the world is formed. I get it all the time. But it's so cool with the duality of that. We're like, we are just projections of your psyche, Brandon. Here.
Oh, come on. Don't say that. You're going to make me get all,
I'll flip it.
All
like, but then also,
no, I believe it.
Yeah. Also, you're a projection of mine, and somehow it all works out. And somehow this is all my story, but it's your story too. I don't know.
That's where it's so weird.
I just want to add that I don't know if this has been so strong for me ever before, but your story about you getting up off the floor and you and your buddy mirroring each other's movements and doing like kung fu moves in the middle. So like, I really want an animated version of that, or like a, almost like, you know, that show Drunk History on Comedy Central where people tell the story. Like, I want it to be you telling that story. And I just want to see this image of like two famous actors, like, mimicking, like standing up in your living room pretending to do kung fu at each other while your wife, not high, sits there on the couch watching like, what the fuck have I got myself into?
Well, let's just throw the intention out here, because I do think we can find someone to animate clips of the podcast, and let's just do it.
Yeah, someone, if you're out there, please contact us.
Get her done. Part of that, yeah.
I mean, the other thing that happened, I had, and this was like a big one, like this was the takeaway for some reason from my first time getting high, is like, I told him, I said, well, I can see your aura. And he's like, well, what color is it? And I said, it's yellow, golden color. And then my wife says, well, what color is mine? And I'm like, I can't see it. I can't see your aura. Like,
gotta get high, girl.
Exactly. It was because she wasn't high, and like she didn't like that. You know that. And understandably, it's like because she was the outsider at that moment. She was the one that was like different. So I'm like connecting with my coworker, and he's like, "Well, describe my aura." And I said, "I don't know how to describe it, other than this." And I stood up, and then maybe I can do it for you a little bit, but I've got headphones in right now. But I hopped on one foot like this, and I twirled my hands like this in the circle, and I hopped like this. And I said, Angel Gold Spirit. And I threw it at him. And I did it over and over. I was like, Angel Gold Spirit. And I was like, that's what it is. That's what your aura is. Angel Gold Spirit, hopping on one foot, moving my hands in this circular motion and throwing it at you at the end.
Angel Gold
Spirit. I wish people listening could see the actions involved in Angel Gold Spirit, because it's followed shortly thereafter by one of you saying, anyway, now that we're both standing up, do you want to do taekwondo?
Oh, smokes.
Man. So, yeah. So
what else do you want to hit on? What else do you want to talk about?
I mean, here's the thing. We haven't even scratched the surface, but we've been going for an hour and a half. We got to like, so what we got to do now is be like, okay, Brandon, we got to figure out when, like, give us a little more info about the book. It's called Mormon on Mushrooms. It's like we are connected. The three of us are connected with that name. When can people start hoping to be able to find and purchase this book?
Well, if enough people are interested, then I can use those numbers to try to justify getting an agent to get this book published. That's the thing. I had an article published on Vice. I have no idea how many people have read it. I don't know if 1,000 people read a Vice article, 10,000 or 1,000,000. I have no idea. So yeah. I want to be able to use that to get an agent to get this thing published. I have bigger goals beyond that. But so I got to get it published first. email me, mormononmushrooms@gmail.com, if you're interested. And but there are no details yet. I've had a draft ready for a couple of years. I keep fiddling with it. I think it's pretty good, but I'm biased. But yeah, it tells my story, growing up Mormon, not really believing, how to deal with that, getting married, details about marriage, discovering Terence McKenna, getting into psychedelics, finding Joseph Smith, likely use psychedelics, leave the faith, start using psychedelics myself, have some pretty profound experiences that lead to moving to Australia, starting over. And then, but that wasn't even, that was off of eating edibles that experience happened.
God, that's so crazy. Yeah.
I mean, do we have some more time? Cause I would love to hear like one of your like psychedelic experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we have to have one of those.
We have to. Yeah. How could we not? Please. Yeah.
Okay. But the book concludes with my first mushroom experience. It was 4 grams, so it wasn't technically a hero's journey.
Yeah, but 4 grams, no joke.
That's the most we've taken. Yeah. And that's what I've taken. I don't know about you, Doug, but.
Oh, yeah, same. Yeah.
I did it with you, Doug.
Yeah, we did it together.
We were scampering around a campground in Zion's National Park.
Never before has there been a perfect like time for Yakety Sax, like a Benny Hill skit, you and me on 4 grams of mushrooms. It's like, and I'm like saying, Mike, what do we do about those people that are closing the awning on their trailer? And you're like, I think we just allow it to happen. And I'm like, really? Anyway, yeah.
Then we found the river and it was like this holy moment with the moon and the river. And we were feeling the energy there. Remember that?
Oh, man, I can be back in that spot right now.
It was good. Anyway.
Anyway. Yeah. Sorry, Brandon. The 4 grams. No,
it's just fascinating. Like, because this is what's weird about psychedelic experiences. Look, I'm not like super experienced. I've done like
same
10 maybe same. Psychedelic experiences, different forms, different degrees, different doses and all that, but probably 10, what I call psychedelic experiences. And so, as you're talking about that, I know what you mean, the spirit of your comment about like somebody closing the awning or whatever you're saying, and about how this is like some earth shattering moment in going into a river with the moon, like just changed the course of your life. Okay. Yeah. Hearing those words as an outsider is like, what are you talking about? But then I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay? So, yes. Like that's the stuff, like the most simple thing can become the most like puzzle concluding, like a piece of a puzzle that concludes. And when it happens in the moment, like in that psychedelic moment, you're like, you really see the secrets of the universe. But then once you're sober, it's like, I just saw the secret of the universe. Let me tell you. And then like,
yeah, you think you have this whole, you think you have this whole profound thing to say. And it's like, oh, it was 2 a.m. and I stood by a river that the moon was reflecting in, and I used my hands to put some of the water from the river onto my face, and I felt the connection from moon, earth, fire, air. It was everything, you know, it was elemental. And then people hear it and they're like, it sounds to me like you were just fucked up.
Yeah. I'm like, yeah, exactly.
I know. Yeah.
Well, that night I did see a pillar of light directly above my head, brighter than the sun,
which descended gradually and fell upon me.
Oh, did you guys want to hear that in Chinese? You've taken 4 grams. Tell us about that. Yeah.
Okay, but that's the concluding moment in the book, which I can tell you what happens.
Are you saying you're spoiling something in the book?
I don't want to do spoiler here.
I mean, it's a spoiler. I mean, but like, it is, but like, it doesn't matter. Like, I could tell you the whole book, and I think you'd still want to read it.
Yeah,
I think
I do want to read it.
Yes. But I keep doing this because I'm about to speak for 20 minutes, you know,
it's perfect.
But, I'd moved to Australia, but we had to go back to the US for something. So my wife was involved in a work thing. Anyway, we had to go back for a couple weeks. And during that time, I met up with my friend, Tommy, who I talked about, who I did the passing out experience, and he had seizures in high school. he had started to get into psychedelics at the time. He wasn't Mormon or never Mormon or anything. Mm-hmm. And he had gotten into psychedelics, and he had gotten into edibles, and he smoked a bit, but he'd never done a true psychedelic. But he had a brother-in-law, ironically named Angel.
What?
No joke. Yeah. His brother-in-law named Angel, was big into psychedelics and very well connected in a community in Northern California. And he doesn't deal or anything like that. He's just connected to people that have,
yeah.
And so he was able to hook him up with a lot of stuff as a wedding gift.
Ooh, and as a wedding gift.
Yeah.
I love this guy.
Yeah. And so he hooked up Tommy with a lot of mushrooms, like 12 grams and 15 grams, I think it was. And that coincided with my trip to California. It was in Big Bear, which is this place in the San Bernardino Mountains. And Tommy's aunt has a cabin there. And we went to the cabin for a weekend, and we were all going to do, me, Tommy and his wife, were going to do mushrooms, but we had it coordinated. So there was always a watcher. We knew the mm-hmm. sequence that we were going to do all this stuff. None of us had experienced it before, but we were well read on the subject. And, so took every precaution necessary to do it, and had this appropriate set and setting and all this stuff, knew that number of hours.
I mean,
anyway,
Big Bear up amongst those trees. I mean, that's a good energy there. Yeah.
It was very good energy. We stayed in the cabin the whole time. Like I could not go outside.
Like you're still in the energetic aura of the trees.
Yes. It was an idyllic setting. And anyway, I ate 4 grams of mushrooms, and we're listening to the soundtrack by John Hopkins University. You could listen on Spotify specifically for psilocybin. And at like track number 3, it's like 15 minutes into it, I just like kind of lean back and I look up at the ceiling, and it's this wooden ceiling, and the grains in the wood start to look like they're moving like fire. And I'm like, whoa. And I'm like, this is just the beginning.
Oh, love it.
And then
I just wish listeners could see your face when you do that, man. I just gives me chills in the good kind of way.
So I see that, and then the next thing I'm on the floor, and like a couple of minutes later, I'm looking at, they have this I thought it was an air conditioner at the time, was a heater, doesn't make a difference, that's in the wall. I'm looking at it, it looks just like a furnace, like a furnace, like an Isaiah type furnace, like from the Old Testament. And it's like, I'm like, I don't know what I'm looking at. Actually, before that, this is interesting. The first realization I had under mushrooms, and I haven't followed this order from the mushroom, is I stood up after seeing the flames in the ceiling. I stood up and I said, I'm supposed to start swearing, and I'm supposed to start interrupting people. This is going to help me if I allow myself to interrupt people and I start swearing. And then my friend's wife, who's in there, she's our watcher at the time, I said to her, I'm sorry, I apologize for this. But then I just started swearing. But the thing was, I didn't like start swearing. I said all these super vulgar things. And it was like, not just like the 7 words you can't say on TV. It was just like super vulgar things. And then I realized after that, I'm like, what did I just do? I wasn't swearing. I just like said a bunch of vulgar things. That's like very different from one another. But then I left that moment, and I was on the floor looking at the furnace, and it was like all changing colors. And then and like, I even hesitate swearing right now. I'm still not comfortable with it. It's like, I'm like, I don't know what the fuck I'm looking at. I don't know what the fuck, what is this? What is this furnace thing? And then it was just like laughing at it. And then I went into the bedroom and I laid down on their bed, and then boom, I had this moment with this octopus, multi-limbed Hindu goddess, where I saw her, and she's swimming in this, it's like a space-like, oh, I don't have the image here. I used to have a painting on the wall right here that I did of it, but I don't know where it is now. Oh, that's sad. It would have been nice to show you.
I see a rainbow back there.
No, that's for my daughter. But I have kids and they do psychedelics.
That's pretty.
It's okay. It's okay. That's the thing. We're breaking taboos right now. I'm telling you, that's totally normal. But I know
people don't feel comfortable
with that. But so I had this incident with this Hindu goddess. Mm-hmm. She's floating in this space-like, water-like material. and she's blue. She has multi limbs. And then what happens is that this chant from this psilocybin music track from Johns Hopkins is playing in the background, and she starts to open her mouth. And when she opens her mouth, she starts to spew out this, like, this, what looks like spinal material. Like, it looks like the columns from a spine, but they're like perfectly formed, and it kind of looks like DNA too. And she opens her mouth with the chant, in sync with the chant. And when she does it, spews out of her mouth. And I understand at the moment that she's somehow creating the primal elements of matter, and she does it through singing. And I don't know what this means, but that's what's happening. So I'm seeing like the creation process happening right there, and it just like spins out of her mouth, and it's like the most beautiful thing but haunting at the same time. And she's just showing me how it's done as she's waving these multi limbs around. And then the song ends, and then she says, "You've had enough." And then I follow this spinning DNA primal material from her mouth, and it takes me into what is the underworld. And I see like these Easter Island type stone sculptures. They're on the what seem like the bottom of the ocean, and they're like kind of rusting, and there's like this debris in front of them, and they're like, "You're in the underworld." And I said, "Well, what do I do?" And he says, "You can come in." I said, "How do I come in?" And he said, "You just do." And I don't know what happened. My mind draws a blank there, but I don't think I entered. And then what happened was then I stood up and I walked in back into the other room where Tommy and his wife were, but I'm starting to see the world with all these shards of light. Like, it looks like a Photoshop blur has been applied to it. And like, I'm in what you think of as like a heaven type scene. And the everything's different colors. I look at my arm, and my arm, each time I look at it, it's like a different complexion. And I'm like, what's going on? And then one time it looks like elephant skin, and I'm like, oh, and I'm starting to get a little freaked out. And I look at my friend Tommy and his wife Jen, and they're like, come here, come sit down. It's good. And Tommy had taken 4 grams too, but he didn't seem like it was that high. And Tommy and Jen was just fine. And so I sit down with them, and they look like Hindu gods, and like from paintings from the past. Like, and Jen, she has like this ashen blue glow to her, not glow, but that's like where her complexion is. And she's like the most beautiful being I'd ever seen. And then my friend Tommy, he's just got like this, and he wasn't wearing this like in real life, whatever real life is, but he's wearing this vest and it's open, and you can see like his belly exposed and everything. He's just like reclining like this. It's like, yeah, it's all good. You're good. You're safe. And I'm like, oh, I'm all uncomfortable. And they're like, you're fine. And then I just retreat and put my head into my hands, and I don't want to look at them because I felt like unworthy to be in their heavenly presence. And then it got super weird after that, where it was like, like the collapse of all matter. Like, I'm back in the womb type imagery. Words don't make sense. I'm just muttering syllables. And then it's just like whatever. And then I start to get teased by the council of the gods, who teach me that they say, we don't even know what's going on. And I like then start to like one up them and show them like, look what I can do. And then they can counter every move that I make, and also counter each of the subsequent counters I'm going to make before I even thank them. And they're like, you're nothing, basically, but so are we. And so then lots of other things happen, but they're super abstract, and eventually I get out of it. But yeah, it was a really interesting experience. But the most interesting thing happened with his wife when she got high the next day. And then that's how the book concludes with what happens to her.
Yeah, let's keep that spoiler. keep that fresh.
It's like a cliffhanger. That's like a cliffhanger, like stay tuned.
Yeah.
Like you've whet our appetites. Now we're like, wait a minute, where's this fucking book?
I do want to say that after Mormon on Mushrooms, I want you to write scripture.
Same, dude. Honestly, same.
Because I want to be like, in the beginning, there was an octopus goddess who spewed forth the DNA of all matter.
And talking about like maybe Kali or something like that with the multiple arms. But then he's like talking about like council of the gods, and they like are ahead of every one of his moves. And like, we can do anything. You're nothing. Also, we're nothing. I'm like, shit, dude. Can I go to there with you, please?
Yeah. My trip reports, I sent one to Doug the other day, and it was like, Bitcoin? Question, question, question.
No, for real though. Okay, this happened the other day, like a few weeks ago. We got, I mean, like I don't like, this was just hitting a bong. Like, bongs are great, by the way. I guess you're only supposed to do them up until you're 18 and you don't do them anymore, but they're great. But
love a bong.
So we did that. I invited a coworker over and I told them, like, and I've had this multiple times about Bitcoin. I was like, I went off on Bitcoin. I don't know much about it, but I said, like, really, Bitcoin? Like, I said, if you put $5,000 into it today, it's going to be $500,000 like very soon. Like, this is this. And I went in off on how it was going to shape the economy and how there's an illusion based on how the current dollar is done, but there is less of an illusion in how Bitcoin is done. And I compared it to the diamond market and how the diamond market is built on the idea that because diamonds aren't rare, they sell them for more money. It's a completely manipulated market. Oh, yeah. Whereas there are far more rare elements that aren't sold for much because there aren't a lot of them. And so what you do is you sell the things there are a lot of for a lot of money because you can make money off of the things that there are a lot of. So it's completely
creating the illusion of value, basically. That's all.
And it's the same thing with the dollar. I don't know, even know what this means, but I went off on when I was high that the dollar is the diamond and Bitcoin is the actual rare coin. And Bitcoin, people will realize this, and that's when Bitcoin is really going to take off.
So first, I want to create a disclaimer that if anyone loses their fortune on Bitcoin, it's not our fault.
I will say that. No, you can sue me. But, no, just kidding.
But that being said, I want to kind of close with it because here's what I wrote. At the end of my trip, I go, Bitcoin, question, question, question. Pretend problems are about pretend money. Let's stop pretending.
Oh, I love that.
And then at the very end, this is interesting. I said, walkabout question. So I'm thinking this means I need to come to Australia and trip with you and go on a walkabout.
Use your Mike, you can, very easily use your Bitcoin gains to finance that trip to Australia. Yeah. Meanwhile, my trip reports to you, Mike, are like, I'm just super grateful for my body.
Oh, I love it.
Oh man. But that's the thing. That's what's so great is everybody has such a different experience, but I think you get what you're prepared for, or what you're supposed to get, whatever that means. That sounds very destiny like, but I don't know what I believe about destiny, that it's somehow choice and destiny are the same thing. I don't even know what that means, but that's what I kind of conclude. But yeah, you get what you're prepared for and get what you need. And they're so different from each other. Whatever psychedelic experience you have.
Oh, I love that. So, Brandon, we're going to put in the show notes, we're going to put a bunch of like links. So we're going to put a link to your article.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put your, if you're okay with it, we'll put your email address in there.
Yeah, you can put my email address. I created it. Yeah.
Just other ways people can find you. What about like, I mean, any social media, anything like that? Anything you want people tracking you down, or would you prefer staying?
I am the only person that under 40, I'll be 40 next month, that has never had a social media account.
Thanks.
Oh, you do? You serious? Yeah. Hey, all right.
Yeah, I can't.
Although I can't Doug make is technically 40 now, but
I am 40. So I guess, I guess I have more of an excuse than you do because it sounds like I'm a little older than you. But I don't know how to do it. It seems to me like hard to navigate and I can't do all the things. In fact, the other night we were talking about a social media post that I was going to make on our Mormons on Mushrooms social media, but I was just like, I don't know how to do it. Like,
I did it today.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't checked. Yeah,
I did. Well, I did on our story, but I was just going to say, Brandon, if you create Instagram, you could be our 2000th follower.
Oh, really?
We're at 1999. Oh, wait, you know what? No, we're at 2000 right now.
All right.
Huzzah, you guys.
Huzzah! Thank you, followers.
Thank you, all of our listeners. Good. Thank you. Thank you, 2,000. That's pretty cool. We never thought we'd have.
That's a lot.
We never thought we'd have 20, but now we have 2,000.
And you've done it fast. It's like 6 months, right?
It's been fun. I mean, so many. Fun. You talk about synchronicities and meeting cool fucking people, and it's just been. I've loved it. Yeah.
Same.
Yeah. And
this has been no exception, Brandon. I can't wait to.
Oh, I can't wait for this episode.
We actually have a lot of listeners in Australia for some reason. I mean, I think maybe we did a course there in Australia. So one day, Doug and I just have to go out there and meet some of our friends out there.
And
meet our people.
I would love to. I have no idea how long we'll be here. I mean, it's a very good place to be COVID wise right now. Except we go under extreme lockdowns. We have, there was one case in the city of Perth, one case, and they shut down the entire city for 5 days.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Like shut down, like you shut down, you don't go outside unless you're going to the, they call it the chemist here. I can't remember what it's called. The like Rite Aid or whatever. Pharmacist.
Yeah.
They go to the pharmacist and grocery store. That's it. Unless you're an essential worker, you stay inside. So we had that basically for 9 months in Melbourne, and it was really, really hard, but we have no cases now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had it. I had it about 6 months ago, and I still don't have my sense of smell. Other than that, that's the only symptom I had. I lost my taste and smell. My taste came back, albeit pretty faint. I can't smell a thing. Like you, the two of you could like atomic sit up me together, like nose in your assholes and fart in my face, and I would not, I would not smell one damn thing. It's weird. It's crazy.
Oh man.
Luckily that's the sense that went away. Cause any of the other five senses, like if my vision went away for 6 months, people would be like, we got to find a fucking cure. We got to like lock down. We got to do this shit.
Oh, for real. Yeah. That's, I never even thought about that. The two senses to lose that are the least value are those.
Exactly. Rank. Yeah. We rank our senses. Cause touch, hearing and sight would be like, oh shit, we need to like do something here.
Oh man. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah.
Crazy. I want to have you back, and if you're willing to do this again,
I would love to do it again. Yeah, and so like you know, maybe when the book is actually going to be published, we do another one, or just for fun sometime. If you can't find a guest, which you guys will find awesome guests, you already have, and they'll continue to find you serendipitously through this world. But I'd love to chat again. Email me, and I mean that for real. Like I enjoy contact through email. So. And I'm saying that to all the listeners, whoever's out there. So, awesome.
All right. Thanks so much, dude. Love you. That was awesome.
All right. Okay. All right. We'll chat later.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to Mormons on Mushrooms podcast. We have so much fun recording it. And if you love it, we would absolutely love it if you could leave a review on wherever you get your podcasts. It would really help our visibility so more people can listen to it and be enlightened and hear our crazy stories. So thanks again for tuning in.